Thank you. Okay, yeah, so splicing together two topics today. Both are united under the theme of being about the adiabatic algorithm. So the first topic is going to be different strategies, which I did with Eddie Farhi and some others at MIT. And the second topic is going to be about sort of simulated quantum annealing. And so there's some numerical work that's already out and also some theoretical work that I'm doing with my advisor, Aram Harrow. Okay, so, and I'm going to start sort of kind of basic with just an introduction to optimization and the adiabatic algorithm, and then I'll jump into, you know, what's new in these results. Okay, so the quantum adiabatic optimization solves difficult combinatorial problems by encoding them into quantum spin systems, right? So these problems sort of involve minimizing or maximizing some function on a domain of, say, bit strings. And so, you know, this captures many important problems in computer science, both of practical and theoretical interest. And, you know, so oftentimes as theorists, we consider an optimization algorithm intended to solve one of these problems to be efficient if it minimizes this function in, you know, some polynomial time, and inefficient maybe if it requires exponential time, right? And so many optimization problems are in this complexity class, NP, and in fact they're hard for the problems in this class, and you know, basically we all believe that this means that they're going to be hard for both classical and quantum computers, right? So what we're really interested in is maybe not in the worst case of these problems that take exponential time, but sort of what can we do for the average case? You know, what kind of heuristics can we come up with that can effectively get useful solutions to some problems in this class? Okay. So here's just going to be a very explicit example where I take a computer science problem called Boolean satisfaction, and I map it onto a two-local quantum Hamiltonian for a spin system like we're familiar with, right? So I recognize a lot of the audience here is quantum information people, so, you know, I think we all kind of are familiar with two-sat, right, where you have sort of a conjunction of clauses using and, or, and not, and this is relevant because sort of the different strategies for adiabatic optimization were, we actually worked with an ensemble of two-sat instances. Now, two-sat for satisfiable instances are known to be easy. That's known to be NP. But if we consider frustrated instances of two-sat, right, so that's the max two-sat problem, satisfying the maximum number of clauses, then that is also NP hard. And so here I just kind of go through and, right, so we can sort of take these Boolean variables and map them onto spin variables such that the logical formula is satisfied if and only if we're in sort of the ground state of, you know, this sum of terms here. And, okay, so having said that, you know, how do we look at quantum adiabatic optimization? Well, you have some function f that maps bit strings onto real numbers, and you can encode that into a Hamiltonian that's diagonal in the computational basis, right? And in fact, in this work, we're going to consider instances that have a unique maximum satisfying assignment, right? So even though the instances are frustrated, they have a unique maximum satisfying assignment, and I'm going to refer to that as W for the winner. Okay, so the unique string that minimizes F corresponds to the computational basis state that is the ground state of this HP. All right, and so the general idea is to produce the ground state of HP using a time-dependent transverse field, right? So just wanted to get this normalization right, but this is essentially a uniform sum over the sigma X spins, and that's what I mean by a transverse field, right? And so we have some total time that we're going to run the algorithm for, and so t is time, and so starting at t equals 0, we are just entirely in the uniform transverse field, which has a very simple ground state. It's just the uniform superposition of computational basis states, and Then at the end of the evolution, when little t equals big T, then we're entirely looking at the problem Hamiltonian. So the way this works is using the adiabatic theorem, which is going to tell us how slowly do we have to evolve this Hamiltonian, how large does capital T have to be in order to solve the problem. So let's define this measure of the success probability for a particular capital T as the overlap with the winner state, right? So psi of T here is kind of the time evolved state under Schrödinger evolution for the adiabatic Hamiltonian. And this P of T quantity is going to feature really throughout the first half of this talk. Right, so I think most of us know that the runtime for adiabatic optimization is primarily bottlenecked by the minimum spectral gap of the Hamiltonian throughout the evolution. And that's due to this adiabatic theorem, which sort of guarantees that, you know, if capital T is larger than some polynomial in N and polynomial in the inverse gap, then P of T is going to be close to 1. If you actually find an expression of the adiabatic theorem that looks exactly like this, tell me, because the best ones I know show this for, you know, G min to the 2 plus delta for any delta greater than 0. So, you know, but this is basically how people talk about it in practice. But if you want to be absolutely rigorous, you need a more careful statement of the adiabatic theorem, clearly. But for our purposes, hard instances are those with an exponentially small minimum gap. And in this work, though, we're going to kind of take a different direction. And we're going to ask, is it possible to increase the success probability for hard instances when you're not in the adiabatic regime? So capital T is actually much less than what the adiabatic theorem says that would be sufficient. Okay. And so what we did was we generated a lot of instances of max2sat. Right? So this is going to be computational, and I'm going to, you know, maybe that's not our favorite, but you know, we'll just stick with it, and I think the results will be reasonably satisfying. But anyway, so we're going to work at 20 bits here, which is a small enough system size that it's possible to do the exact Schrödinger evolution, or to numerically approximate it, right? Just by writing down these large matrices, 2 to the 20, you know, is something about a million. So you have these large sparse matrices, and we're evolving them using Runge Kutta, and that's how we can kind of simulate the adiabatic algorithm in this project. So this is actually massive. So we actually used a large cluster of computers. This took about 20,000 hours of CPU time, and we generated 200,000 instances and collected just this ensemble of 137 hard instances, the hardest. And those we defined as having less than a success probability less than 10 to the minus 4 at a particular time scale, capital T equals 100, at which the vast majority of instances, you know, have above 99% success probability. Right? So when you're working at a finite N, you kind of have to make these choices of a particular time scale and a particular cutoff for these success probabilities, and those are those parameters. So now what's the surprise? Is that hard instances have a peak in the success probabilities at relatively smaller values of capital T. So this was actually, this picture here found on a particular instance is what kind of launched this whole project. And this is what kind of should strike us as surprising, right? So this instance has success probability around 10 to the minus 5th as we go on for a long, long time. You know, this graph only goes out to 200, but you could go to capital T equals 10,000, and it would still have this, you know, negligibly small success probability. And so this is a case, and right, whereas we have this short time peak on a logarithmic scale where the success probability is, you know, 5%. So we've gone from a 1 out of 10,000 chance of finding the winning assignment to, you know, a 5% chance of finding it. And that's surprising. Right, that really goes against our intuition. I mean, I think if you took somebody who's looked at the adiabatic algorithm and said, hey, does it surprise you that the success probability is not monotonic as a function of the runtime, they'd say, no, that's not so surprising. But you know, this sharp peak right at the beginning and then a complete flatline as time goes on. I think that's what's interesting about this. So let's investigate this instance further. Sure enough, it does have a small gap. The minimum gap is small. You can kind of see it here, where we have this avoided level crossing. And okay, so let's look at sort of what the expectation of the energy in the instantaneous state produced by the Schrödinger evolution looks like for the two evolution timescales, right? So one is slow, t equals 100, one is faster, t equals 10. Now, for t equals 100, we see you follow the ground state until you reach the avoided crossing, but then it just sort of jumps up and follows the first excited state from then on, right, very closely. And whereas the fast evolution, well, it starts to leave the ground state before we've even crossed the minimum gap, right? So maybe this picture doesn't exactly tell us why the faster evolution is producing a higher overlap. So to see that, we can look at this graph. Here in blue is the overlap with the ground state. And this is all for the fast evolution with big T equals 10. And so we can kind of see that whatever amplitude you have in the, right, and so the reddish is in the first excited state. And whatever amplitude you have in the first excited state before the minimum gap kind of gets swapped with the amplitude of the ground state, right? So the fact that you kind of were evolving faster and you were having some non-adiabatic effects in the first part of the evolution allows you to have some amplitude in the ground state after the avoided crossing, right? Whereas you have very little if you had evolved the system more slowly, right? If we evolved the system slowly, then this line here would be sort of a flat line. And so when we did the swap, you know, it would still be flat in the ground state. Okay, so this all looks like I'm just showing you one particular instance, but this turned out to be true for all of the hard instances that we generated. And that's what this plot shows. So on this side, you have the success probability at time 100 versus sort of the maximum. If you were to somehow know the capital T, you know, that maximizes it. Now, all these capital T's are kind of in that same range around 10, but okay, we'll get to that. And basically, so this would be like a 45-degree line. And the fact that all of our data points are to the right of this line kind of tells us that everything has seen improvement, you know, by a factor of hundreds to 1,000, right? So here's what the distribution of those Tmax look like, just to nail that down. But of course, you can't actually, you know, take the time to find Tmax for each particular instance. So what we really care about is could you just run it for a short time and see an improvement from that? And sure enough, we can. So, you know, if we just compare P of 10 versus P of 100 for all of these hard instances, we see they're all improved, generally by a factor of 100 or more. Okay, and so now that we have a nice proper explanation of this phenomenon, we can ask the question of whether it's possible to exploit the phenomenon more directly by preparing the system in an excited state at the start of the evolution. Right, and then evolving it adiabatically so that when you hit the minimum gap, right, you had all the amplitude in the first excited state, and after the minimum gap, you have all the amplitude in the ground state. So we did that, and it turns out that works. Right, so you have, you know, the initial Hamiltonian, that uniform transverse field has 20 excited states, 20 first excited states for a 20-bit instance, and so. So this shows sort of the average success probability for preparing it in each of those 20 excited states. And basically, the fact that most of the instances are bunched up near 1 over 20 shows us that we it works as well as we could possibly hope. And it sort of saturates this upper bound given by conservation of probability. Okay. All right, so now I'm going to kind of tunnel over to a different topic, switching gears from different strategies to now we're going to talk about simulations of the adiabatic algorithm. So here I want to distinguish three optimization algorithms that are all inspired by physics. One of them is simulated annealing, which is something you could program on a classical computer. And it's inspired by a certain physical process, which is sort of cooling, right? So I think we're all familiar with this idea, where you want to produce the ground state, you want to produce a better ground state by first heating things up and then slowly cooling it to find a low energy state. And I'm going to contrast simulated annealing now with quantum annealing, which is something you would perform on actual quantum hardware. This is a quantum device. And now, just to keep these all straight, so simulated quantum annealing is something you do on a classical computer inspired by the physics that are going on in a quantum device. Okay, so how does simulated quantum annealing work? How do you write down a classical algorithm inspired by a quantum device? Well, the answer is we're going to use something called path integral Monte Carlo. And this is sort of a standard textbook technique. It's based on a trotterization of the quantum adiabatic optimization Hamiltonian. That produces maybe a little bit of error, but it's something we can control really well, so we don't really worry about that. And then we apply this quantum to classical mapping, which introduces an imaginary time direction. So I couldn't really write down the entire derivation of this, but I'm going to try to give you a flavor of it. So first of all, the important thing that's happening is that we're mapping a quantum thermal density matrix onto a classical Boltzmann distribution. Okay? And so these two lines kind of give you an idea of the steps that are involved. So you start with a Hamiltonian that is a sum of two non-commuting terms, essentially the x terms and the z terms, right? And then in this step, you sort of do trotterization. And then in this step, we've kind of repeatedly inserted the identity. And that's where you get this imaginary time direction. You get all of these extra, right? You have a sum over a length L sequence of computational basis states. Right? So right, the goal is to massage this until it starts to look like a classical Boltzmann distribution, maybe over some much larger domain because of all of these extra computational basis states we've added. Right? So, you know, what would you do from here? Well, so we're going to skip a few steps when I go to the next slide, so maybe I can just kind of say in words what we do. So HZ, you know, these are computational basis states, so this is just going to evaluate to a number. And then here, you have some exponential of a sum of sigma x terms, right? And so that looks like, right, an exponential of a sum looks like a product of exponentials. And the sigma x terms are all one local. So the product of exponentials, each one is one local, right? So you think of each of these z sub i's as made of n bits, and the x terms are going to couple sort of the jth term of zi to the jth term of zi plus one, right? That's that one locality. So, right, the goal is to turn this all into a sum over e to the something, right? Because that's what a classical Boltzmann distribution looks like. Okay, so let's kind of jump to the answer and hope that it makes sense. So this is E classical here, right? And it's a function on this larger domain of length L sequences of n-bit strings. And so here's what we get for the diagonal term, right? Where we have our original function that we're trying to optimize, but now it has sort of been diluted by this factor of L, which is going to be interesting. And then we have this piece here that sort of couples the corresponding, you know, couple zi to zi plus one, and it's just sort of a simple ferromagnetic icing coupling, right? Sort of because of the simple nature of the off-diagonal terms in our Hamiltonian, because they're uniform, we get this translationally invariant form. And in fact, you can imagine that as the adiabatic parameter S approaches 1, it becomes, right, we get less and less strength on the sigma X terms. And so what that starts to do is means that it's harder and harder to flip a bit as you go between these. So this coupling J starts to blow up to infinity as S approaches 1. Okay, so this picture, you know, if maybe those equations were a little too unpleasant, you know, this picture is the right thing to keep in mind. So each of the ZIs now is, we could call it a slice made of n bits, and they couple to the future slice by this coupling J, and within each slice we have a contribution that goes like beta F over L. So this is kind of the setup. And at this point, this really is just a classical energy function, and we want to sample the Boltzmann distribution of this classical energy function. So how do we do that? Well, we can sample from this distribution pi using a Markov chain. And so maybe this isn't as familiar to physicists, which is good. We can go over it. And so a Markov chain, right, is well, in this case, we're going to use local moves. And that's not the only choice. But you want to have some set of moves that allows you to explore the entire domain. And the key, and by domain, I mean the set of all length L sequences of n-bit strings. And the key, what allows us to get the correct probabilities of the distribution we're trying to sample from is that we have this transition rule that satisfies detailed balance or reversibility. Okay, and this is actually just a particular choice we can make, and this is the Metropolis rule, right? So the probability of jumping from some, right? I don't know if these bold Z's show up too well, but right, bold Z is the entire configuration, the entire length L sequence, and the probability of moving between from Z to Z prime, right, is kind of given by the ratio of the stationary probabilities. If that's less than one, otherwise it's just, you know, one. So what am I really saying, right? It's the usual thing, the usual Metropolis rule. You propose a bit flip, and if it lowers the energy, you accept it. And if it raises the energy, then you accept it with some probability that is sort of proportional to the difference in energies. And so in this framework, the runtime of our classical simulation corresponds to the mixing time of this Markov chain. And bounding the mixing time is a challenging problem in general. I'll mention one technique that's often used to bound the mixing time is related to the spectral gap of the transition matrix P. Right, so the largest eigenvalue of P is 1, and then sort of the gap to the next largest eigenvalue kind of controls the rate of mixing. Okay. So, all right, so let's apply this to a particular problem. The particular problem is called the Hamming weight with a spike. It's kind of a simple toy problem that was originally designed to separate simulated annealing from quantum annealing. Okay, so simulated annealing takes exponential time to find the minimum for this problem. Okay, so let me actually say what this is. So. This here represents the Hamming weight of the bit string Z, which sort of counts the number of ones, right? So right, this is very simple in terms of, okay, so if the Hamming weight is anything other than n over 4, then our energy value is just that. Here, let me just draw a picture. Right, so right, it just looks like a simple linear potential, but this introduction of a spike is actually enough to mess things up for, okay.
Can everyone see that?
Yes.
Drawing
okay,
a picture.
Okay, I'm turning off the lights again.
Okay, thanks.
Maybe we can reach a compromise. How about that?
That's good.
Okay.
Okay. So what happens is, you know, initially when you run simulated annealing, you start at a high temperature. And so when we're at a high temperature, your distribution is concentrated around Hamming weight n over 2. That's what you get just from a random shrink. And as you start to lower the temperature, then, you know, you're going to be looking at sort of the free energy, right? So as you start to lower the temperature, you move down in Hamming weight. You start to feel the function f more and more so. But then when classical simulated annealing reaches n over 4 plus 1 Hamming weight, it's unable to sort of step onto this spike, right? And right, because the spike has height n, and so you have, you know, an e to the minus beta n probability of stepping onto the spike at all, and so it has to take exponential time. And what was previously shown is that quantum annealing then actually has an inverse polynomial minimum gap, and it's possible to show that it solves this problem in linear time, right? So this is a, even though it's a very simple instance, it's nice because it produces this exponential separation between simulated annealing and quantum annealing. So the open question then that I looked at is, how does simulated quantum annealing fare in this problem? Does it inherit the quantum advantage, right? Or does it end up having the same deficiencies as classical simulated annealing? Okay, so numerically, we find that simulated quantum annealing actually discovers the minimum in polynomial time. So the number of sweeps sort of needed to mix and correctly sample the distribution scales is like n squared. Sorry, each sweep here means sort of updating all the spins in the entire Monte Carlo configuration. And so one thing that I left out so far is that in order to get this result that simulated quantum annealing finds the minimum in polynomial time, we need to have the Trotter number, the number of slices we've included, scale linearly with n. And that's actually unusual if you look at, say, condensed matter applications of the path integral Monte Carlo, since typically you're just worried about making L large enough to approximate the quantum thermal density matrix within some multiplicative error. But in our case, because we have this sort of high energy, short time event that we want to capture, our discretization in imaginary time has to be very fine. Let me actually just explain. One thing that I left out is, you know, why do we call this imaginary time? And it's because sort of the partition function or the thermal density matrix, right, looks like e to the minus beta h. That's similar to seeing like a unitary time evolution, but where we've said that t equals maybe some imaginary I tau or something like that, right? So that's not really needed for the derivation or understanding of what we're doing, but it is a useful kind of language to talk about it. So anyway, so this is interesting. And sort of the back of the envelope reason why you need L to scale linearly with N is that, you know, otherwise your probability of stepping on the spike is going to be exponentially small as well. Okay, so this is something that you know, you usually don't see, where to capture the quantum effect that we're looking for, we need to take a large L. And another thing that's kind of cool, so we can actually kind of understand where this n squared dependence comes from, and it's from the fact that, so if we get rid of the spike and you just consider the potential that is equal to the Hamming weight, then that corresponds to like a one local Hamiltonian, right? And so if we go back to this picture, right, so you imagine there are n bits here. You know, because the Hamiltonian, all the terms are one local, they would sort of all decouple from each other. And we would essentially get long one-dimensional chains along this imaginary time direction. Right? Each one is a one-dimensional chain. And since they have this ferromagnetic coupling, they're all just one-dimensional icing models. Okay, so what happens with the one-dimensional icing model? Well, we know there's no phase transition at temperatures greater than zero, but as you approach zero, you get a critical slowdown, right? And the dynamical exponent for that zero temperature phase transition is exactly z equals 2, right? So that's basically what's happening here. And so oftentimes, to overcome this critical slowdown in practice, people will use these world line updates, right, where you sort of delete the trajectory of a spin and resample it using a marginal distribution that's left over from all of the other spins. But, you know, in our case, if we're just concerned with, you know, is it polynomial time or exponential time, then we don't really worry about this small polynomial factor of critical slowdown. Okay, so what's our idea for proving that this works, right? So we can get a provable, what we're aiming to do is get a provable exponential separation between simulated quantum annealing and simulated annealing, right? And that's not been done before. And so the idea is to look at the amount of time that a configuration spends on the spike, right? So define this quantity B as sort of the number of imaginary time slices in a particular configuration that live on the spike. And let's define these sets, capital B sub K, as sort of the set of all configurations that spend about the same amount of time on the spike. And the reason we're doing this is because sort of even though they're all spending some time on this large high energy spike, but because everything in the set is sort of has a similar weight, they can, within a certain set B sub K, you expect that you can move between configurations similarly as you would do with the one-dimensional Ising model, right? So in other words, so mathematically, what I'm really saying is that you can do a comparison between the Markov chain that represents these one-dimensional Ising models and sort of the Markov chain that I've discussed so far restricted to this set B sub K. Okay, and then you have these different B sub K's, and the way you show mixing within each one is by comparing it to sort of the 1D Ising model restricted to those configurations. And then we just need to show that there's this sort of overall block chain that mixes between the various B sub K's. And so because that's sort of a one-dimensional kind of hopping, right, you're only ever in one B sub K at a time. And so that's what's called a birth and death chain, right? Sort of like a one-dimensional single particle hopping. And if you think about it, we would expect the stationary distribution on that space to be unimodal, right? And so really what you're thinking about when you're talking about mixing time of Markov chains is sort of flows on the domain of the chain, right? You want to show that there are no bottlenecks that trap your flow of probability, right? And so if you have sort of a one-dimensional you have this one-dimensional thing kind of hopping between these, right? But you imagine that the stationary distribution is unimodal, well, then you don't have any bottlenecks, right? So within each B sub K, you can get a comparison and you can move between the B sub K because they're overall unimodal. And what I really like about this idea, so even though we haven't worked out all the details yet, a lot of it's working so far, but what I like about this idea is it could potentially generalize, I think, to an understanding of tunneling in simulated quantum annealing. Because what this really is the amount of time that we're spending in the classically forbidden region, right? So typically in a realistic problem, you know, you're hoping that quantum annealing helps you find better solutions by tunneling through high energy barriers. And so maybe the way we could quantify that on the simulated quantum annealing side is by sort of projecting down onto this chain that just keeps track of how much time a configuration spends in the various classically forbidden regions. Okay. So I'll conclude maybe with a summary and some open questions. We found that non-adiabatic effects can significantly increase the success probability for hard instances of max two-set at n equals 20 bits. And for this audience, the question that's probably on everyone's mind is, can these strategies work at larger n, you know, where typical instances are expected to be hard for quantum adiabatic optimization? But at least now we know it's something to look for, something to look at, right? It doesn't hurt to just run these instances for a short time and kind of see what happens. So one way to view this at, you know, once people have built sort of a quantum annealing machine, then, you know, we can play around with these heuristics. And this is just sort of a first indication that some of those, that you know, that minimum gaps might not be the whole story. And just because a certain family of instances has a small minimum gap doesn't mean that the adiabatic algorithm, you know, is completely doomed. Okay? And then the other half, well, we've shown that simulated quantum annealing can inherit some of the advantages, at least some, of quantum annealing on quantum hardware, and can be exponentially faster than simulated annealing. At least it appears that way. And so maybe the open question a lot of people have looked at is, can quantum annealing generally be simulated on a classical computer with polynomial overhead? Right? That's within the realm of conceivability. And you know, it comes down to showing, can we take sort of these general conditions that occur in a realistic quantum annealing system? So you have a local Hamiltonian and you have this inverse polynomial gap, and can you somehow translate that into rapid mixing of the corresponding quantum Monte Carlo Markov chain, which is interesting because the spectral gap kind of plays a role in that mixing too. So is it possible to relate those two? That's kind of an exciting open question. Thank you.
Questions?
So all the way back in the first half, can you show that slide that had the three energy levels?
Sure.
That one. Yeah, actually, I think it's the next one that I wanted. Yeah.
Sure.
So I didn't quite get why in this picture you can see that the slower one is doing better.
Yeah, I agree. That's not completely apparent from just this picture. I mean, I think what this picture shows nicely is that the slower evolution is you know, staying very close to the ground state and then jumping up to the first excited state. And the faster evolution, well, we can see that it has some amplitude already leaving the ground state even before the avoided crossing. But sure, I mean, I agree that this kind of shows it better. Yeah?
Well, okay, that doesn't really show it better to me, because I don't understand what this means, why this is really saying that the slower one is better. I mean, it's just saying that it is better. Question is why it's better. So, but can you go back again to the slide? So, I mean, I guess what's happening in the case of the green one is that it's making then another transition sometimes into that other curve that goes and ends up as the Q ground state. Is that correct, or is it something else that's going on?
So the faster evolution, because it's completely non-adiabatic, not only are we leaving the ground state to spend some amplitude in the first excited state, but also higher excited states than that. Right? And that's, so here's the first excited state energy at the end, but it's clear we have a high overlap maybe with the second and third excited energy states as well. So that doesn't necessarily help us, sure. What does help us is the fact that before the avoided crossing, we have some amplitude in the first excited state. And then when we hit the avoided crossing, that gets swapped down to the ground state. Right? That's what the next picture shows. Oops. The amplitude in the first excited state, right, gets swapped with the amplitude in the ground state. So having this be non-zero is the reason, or you know, having this not be extremely small is the reason that the amplitude in the ground state at the end is not extremely small.
So this is another way to say that, I mean, if you went back to the previous slide, like if you followed, suppose you started in one of the first excited states.
Sure.
And then you slowly, say you follow the t equals 10 thing, then will you just follow the curve and then eventually, if you were to draw the corresponding picture with dots, would it follow the energy eigenstates except for at the avoided crossing where it jumps? Like, is there a state you can start at where you are tracking an eigenstate at all times except at the avoided crossings, and then you end up at the ground state at the end.
So that's actually what we do in this explaining it directly section, right? So we've already kind of understood how this effect benefits us. So what are we saying? We're going to prepare the system in a random first excited state. And in fact, it's possible to do better. You could consider the way that the diagonal Hamiltonian kind of perturbs the off-diagonal, right? So you could do a classical calculation that tells you exactly what that first excited state looks like. That's probably a little excessive to be a realistic strategy.
But like in this case, do you follow an eigenstate more closely? Like when you, on the previous slide, that curve for t equals 10 isn't really following any eigenstate. It's kind of like in between.
Yeah.
But like if you use this strategy, do you actually just follow an eigenstate and then accept that the avoided crossing?
Yeah, sure. So with this strategy, we are evolving the system adiabatically slowly, right? And so, it's adiabatic entirely, but not at
except
the minimum
at the avoided. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So at the minimum gap, you're going to inevitably get this non-adiabatic effect. Yeah.
So I mean, I guess then the question is, should we understand the previous case?
Uh-huh.
As, well, there's some non-adiabatic effect that shifts us into this energy level, and then it kind of behaves adiabatically, following that thing, except crossing over the crossing.
I mean, yeah, so maybe what's missing from this picture is just the t equals 10 evolution. So let's try to map out what it would look like if we made the same picture for the t equals 100 or, you know, even t equals 10,000, then this here would be a complete flat line. Is it shaking?
I think it comes from there.
So this would be a complete flat line here, and you know we would have all of our amplitude would be right. We'd have amplitude 1 all the way out to here, and then it would drop down sharply to 0 all at once, right? So it's actually benefiting us that we're evolving faster and losing amplitude right from the very beginning in the ground state, because the ground state, you know, is not gonna help us once we go through that extremely small minimum gap at the avoided crossing. Yes?
So I see actually the mean vantage simulated annealing. So you have a cost function, which is a function of a large number of continuous factors. So simulated annealing, by virtue of the fact that it's local, actually will put you in some rough minimum function. So the question is there any hope of doing a similar thing with this technique?
So are you considering optimization, say, over a domain of real numbers? Are you considering sort of continuous?
Right. So you have some voltage and you have a lot of control variables.
Mm-hmm.
Figure out how to set the control variables to maximize the voltage.
Mm-hmm.
So simulated annealing has a sort of simple local technique to give you some answer to that. The question is there any way to map that onto this?
Absolutely. Simulated quantum annealing, you could do something similar, right? So oftentimes you would contrast simulated annealing maybe with gradient-based methods for optimization, right? But all three of these are sort of just total black boxes, right, where you don't need to know anything about the structure of the function in advance. You're really just computing changes in the energy due to sort of local moves, right? So simulated quantum annealing is sort of a local, it is a random walk algorithm. I mean, if we want to consider this not as a way to learn about quantum hardware, but just as an optimization algorithm in its own right, then yeah, it's very much like simulated annealing, where you propose local moves, right? And if they lower the energy, you accept them. If they raise the energy, well, you consider accepting it with some probability.
But if you have an enormous, like here you're doing 20 bits, but it doesn't give you an enormous number of bits once you quantize a problem like that?
Okay, so that's actually where transitioning between the two topics might have been a little confusing. So the reason we were restricted to 20 bits for the first topic is because we wanted to write down the entire state vector, right? And we wanted to do everything exactly. But one of the big advantages of simulated quantum annealing is you don't have to keep track of this exponential number of amplitudes. So actually, for example, in the numerical results, which I did with a nice with a summer student over the summer. This is just using C++. We go out to 1,400 spins, you know, and this just maybe takes a few days total to generate all these data points, right? So that we're not at 20 bits anymore. This is now at 1,400 bits, which is not meant to be anything impressive because this problem has a lot of symmetry. But in general, you know, the whole reason for using this kind of quantum Monte Carlo is you're replacing this huge memory structure of keeping track of a state vector with just trying to sample that state vector probabilistically. Right, so it is, I would say it is comparable to classical simulated annealing where you're just essentially doing a local moves, updating a particular configuration in such a way that the local moves sort of sample from the distribution that you care about. Yeah?
I have two questions. You look at the case n equal to 20, and
yeah.
I know that you cannot go through much larger than this, but did you look at 10, 15, 20, and look if the property that you have kind of scale in the right way during that low scaling? That's my first question. Number two is, the idea that you seem to come across is that if you have one avoiding crossing, and you get on the first excited state instead of the ground state, you cross that one, or you go through that one with a higher probability in the ground state.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a second one that comes in,
mm-hmm.
won't you be at the wrong place? Now you'll be in the ground state, it'll be a reverse thing, so you'd have to look at the second excited state and the third one?
Definitely, that's a good question. So one way to kind of answer both of those together is, you know, we considered, you can put the Grover problem into the framework of adiabatic optimization. And that's a case where we have a, you know, sharp quantum lower bound, and so we know that it's not really possible to improve the success probability over what the adiabatic strategy does. So we looked at the Grover problem at, you know, 10, 15, 20 bits, and already at 10 bits, you know, it's hard for these strategies. It's already showing up that you're not increasing the success probability. So, and of course, what causes that is exactly what you're saying. So even if you run the system faster, you know, and that protects you from the first avoided crossing, sort of, okay, one nice feature of this spectrum is that the avoided crossing between the second and third level happens, you know, before the one between the first and second level, exactly. So, you know, if that were to happen afterwards, then we could just cascade on and on and up. And that would be no good. So yeah.
So I assume that this one is not typical.
That's kind of what I'm saying, actually. All of our hard instances, this is typical of all the hard instances for max 2 set at n equals 20 bits. Yeah, that's one thing I definitely want to be clear about is that, you know, they I'm concentrating on one specific instance just to make these plots, but they're all roughly equivalent. You know, they all have, right, the success probability is a function of the total evolution time. They all have this peak at short times. And that's really what struck us and kind of motivated us to you know, share this with everyone. Yeah. It was just one instance. Well, that would just be a coincidence.
And so there's no understanding why crossing between level 1 and 2 arrives before ground state.
Before, after, no understanding at this time. Yeah, it's just something that happens.
So I was wondering, like, did you look at, so there's two other problems that I wonder if this happens for. So one is just regular 2-sat. Because I wonder if max 2-sat at low bit number is kind of more similar to 2-sat than it is to, like, for example, 3-sat. So, like, you know, I wonder, you know, if this phenomenon holds for 2-sat and if it holds for 3-sat, and whether or not max 2-sat is somehow more similar to 2-sat at low bit number. I don't know.
Yeah, we didn't really look at that. You know, we were doing sort of a lot of things surrounding this work, and 2-local ended up being kind of the class we wanted to focus on. So we basically wanted to get an NP-hard class of problems that had a 2-local Hamiltonian. But
it might be. I mean, so like, suppose it were true that for 2-sat, like, this was somehow provably efficient, like the strategy of choosing the first excited state. I mean, for 2-sat, like, people understand, I think, more about the solution space, you know, like, you know, if you flip a bit and what happens and all this stuff. So maybe, you know, maybe this sort of thing is which is true for 2-satin, and then that would be like, if that were the case, you know, even though it's already classically easy, I guess there's very few bit structured problems for which we can analyze the quantum adiabatic algorithms. So might be interesting.
That does sound very interesting to look at, and you know, so of course, even though 2-sat is classically easy, that depends on a specific algorithm that kind of looks at the structure.
Right.
And when you try to use these black boxes, you know, it typically ends up being as hard looking as 3-sat if you don't know about the structure. But yeah, I like that idea. Thank you. Any other questions?
Good discussion. So if there are no more questions, let's thank Elizabeth again.